Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin. With guest co-host...
Stormtrooper 412.
I'm on my iPad.
And straight from the 1970s, here's Mad Jin on AM Radio.
Hello, Internet, and welcome to episode 238. Joined by me today are the lovely panelists, Dan Q.
Autumn is about to fall on us.
The Mian Team.
Greetings, fellow conquerors and future food.
And Mad Jin.
This is my last Polycast.
Let's put that in context, shall we?
This is my last Polycast before Phyrexicon.
I'm Stormtrooper 412, and this is my first appearance in the Polycast.
And hopefully not the last.
Well, yeah.
Wait, what? Wait a minute.
Dan, he's a conqueror, not food. Come on.
All right, speaking of it on and cons.
Yeah, there you go.
And maybe even a Phyrex.
Ah,
I see the what you did there.
Panel descriptions for Phyrexicon. Only four of them, unlike last time when it was wall-to-wall panels, and lots of breaks in between. So I'm beginning to wonder if this Phyrexicon is going to be less than the previous Phyrexicon. Unless, of course, they've got both XCOM 2 and Rising Tide available for people who play constantly throughout the day, in which case breaks are good. First up, in the morning, leading the resistance, a talk on XCOM 2 design and setting. You can see never-before-seen content, mostly because they haven't actually released the game. So pretty much everything's never-before-seen at this point.
Mm-hmm.
After that, after lunch, I guess, raising the stakes, a retrospective on the design and goals of Rising Tide. So you can listen in as the Rising Tide team shares the process behind developing an expansion pack that takes the game in new directions with expanded content and redefined systems.
You know, I
can't say that with a straight face.
I understand what they're getting at, but it's kind of funny to have a retrospective on something that isn't released yet, but okay.
Well, it's going to be released 6 days after Phyrexicon, so one would hope that they still aren't working on it between Phyrexicon and the actual...
No, I think we need to read in between some lines here. It's a retrospective on Rising Tide, so there will be absolutely no updates to it after it's released because they're done. It's retrospect.
Lol.
Yeah. Let's go, go, go.
Flying in the face of modern gaming development.
At least people have stopped calling it postmortem.
Although sometimes that's merited.
Yeah.
Word choice is important. A retrospective can be a postmortem by another name.
Yeah. Just usually people haven't died first.
Usually.
I read a thread on the Escapist forums several days ago, and they said that Phyrexes are a good company, they make good games, yada yada yada. But that guy at one point said that Beyond Earth came out and it absolutely bombed.
Sort of, yeah.
Well, I kind of don't agree with that particular statement. It may have done a bit poorly when compared to Civ 5, but it's not a bad game. It's good. It's cool.
It's there.
And the stuff I've seen so far is quite promising, actually.
Well, as per all things, people keep comparing Beyond Earth's release with Civ 5 vanilla release and yada yada yada.
Mm-hmm.
How bad really was it? All the usual comparisons keep getting made, so who knows? One more expansion might actually make Beyond Earth good.
Yeah, taking from the Civilization 5 example in that perspective, yes, that Gods and Kings, okay, that made it better, but did it make it good? Some people are like, no, that took Brave New World, so, eh.
Moving on, in the mid-afternoon, you have a Civ 5 retrospective. Ooh, more. They're retrospecting the complete edition. You know, it's a retrospective on how they packaged up all their DLC and put it together and did absolutely no work to do that.
So yes, if anyone was still speculating, will there be more DLC for Civ 5? Kind of in the title, probably not.
Yeah, maybe. But you can come and listen to the Civ 5 team as they share never before secrets of early prototype ideas from the prehistory of Civ 5.
Ooh, that could be interesting.
I wonder if it'll be comparable to the prototype talk that Soren Johnson and Dorian Newcombe for Civilization IV back at ApolyCon 2006, 9 years ago. That was very informative, and we got a chance to see with Civ 4 a couple of minutes, like, here is an early prototype. Here is us playing some turns, so you could see what it actually looked like and what it felt like and the decisions they made. So in terms of that kind of a thing, looking at when I say stories of early prototype ideas, I hope that includes some audio visuals as well. Inevitable comparisons will be made to this retrospective to what was done with Civ 4.
True.
Definitely.
After you've had dinner from 6 to 7, you can make life epic. I look back at Sid Meier's beloved classics. So Sid himself and some quote-unquote special guests will be hanging around providing new insight and stories in the development of classic titles like Civilization, Pirates, Railroads, and more.
Ooh. Yeah, Civilization, Pirates, Railroads, and more. Maybe they'll talk about Gettysburg. Maybe they'll talk about SimGolf. I wonder if they'll have a Q&A session. If there's a Q&A session afterwards, if there's someone there at Firaxicon that says, hey, Sid, about that dinosaur game.
I actually became quite good at SimGolf at one point when I was a kid.
People were kids?
Yeah. At one point, even I was.
Or so I heard.
Don't believe you.
It'll be interesting to see what the billeting of the special guests is. And the fact that they got special guests in there tells me, at least reasonably so, that they're still trying to confirm some individuals.
Yeah.
But I would expect, hopefully there'll be some other co-lead designers, some examples that could be Bruce Shelley from the original Civilization, maybe Brian Reynolds, maybe Jeff Briggs, who was involved with Civilization 3, maybe Soren Johnson will be back. Who knows?
Who knows?
Oh, maybe they'll also talk about colonization.
Ooh.
The original, not the Civilization IV colonization. This is beloved classics, by the way. And that's also an interesting question. Classic. What does something have to be in order to be classic? To me, there's like a time has passed, but what is that time? Is it absolute? Is it relative?
I can have instant classics, Stan. I've seen all kinds of sports games claim they're instant classics. It must be true.
Uh-huh. It must be.
But wait a minute, if they said it on the internet, did they say fact at the end of the sentence? Because if they didn't, I call BS shenanigans.
Well, sometimes they do. So those are probably the times where it was actually true. That's how you can tell the difference.
It's great. Life is simple. It really helps us along the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
We finally, air quotes, got to see the mega panel from Firaxis Games from PAX Prime here in 2015. Panel hosted by Chris Waters from GameSpot.com, described as the quote-unquote seventh semi-annual Firaxis Mega Panel. They talked about this XCOM thing. It was there. There was the discussion with Jake Solomon and another individual whose name I can't remember and didn't bother recording, because, of course, our focus is on Civilization Beyond Earth and, of course, the Rising Tide expansion with Will Miller and David McDonough, co-lead designers. Some quotes from the video. Approaching the design of this expansion pack versus the base game, Will Miller said, "We actually looked at what XCOM did with Enemy Within, which really changed the entire experience. We approach BE from that perspective, wanting to change the entire experience and flesh out the base game." To which David McDonough added, "Even the things that are old are made new by the addition of the hybrid affinities and these alternative options that can change the value, timing, or the purpose of the original content, and expansions help us question not just the content, but the design of our systems at a fundamental level," added Will, which I think most of us can agree who have played Beyond Earth. This is good. There are a number of areas that needed improvement, and we've been over that actually a fair bit on this show already since Beyond Earth's release, what, almost a year ago now, was it? That was October last year, right?
Yes, something like that. Wow.
Yeah, almost a year. So yeah, so we have a full-fledged expansion less than a year later. Way to set precedent there, Firaxis.
EA Sports, it's in the game.
David McDonough also added that the power in the making of an expansion is upending the landscape you laid in the base game. Even the title of our expansion references to our effort and interest in raising the stakes and changing the meaning of everything that used to be, adding so much to the game that nothing can be taken for granted again. That's the fun of making an expansion for a game like Civ. They then proceed to show off hybrid affinities, which, above all, drive the military, the way your military diversifies, function in a way that no Civ army ever has. And then we see hybrid units from Purity Supremacy, Purity Harmony, Supremacy Harmony. But my favorite, the best part as far as I'm concerned, is about the aquatic cities from Will Miller. Sort of paint your culture border on the water, and you can paint over other people's, which is pretty neat. It's a different kind of territorial acquisition than land. Can get pretty interesting, especially in multiplayer. You can kind of grief each other painting over your territory. Yeah, we have mentioned that before.
Let's advertise the great thing.
Yeah, but I was wondering, how will that affect the game mechanics? Is that an instant war? What happens if those two civilizations have open borders and stuff like that? What will happen? Try to find an answer to that in a few Let's Plays, but...
Yeah, somebody will get cranky, especially in multiplayer.
Yeah, but does it mean, hey, you just stole my territory, that's an instant declaration of war? Or maybe does it work like the Great General Citadel back in Civ 5, when you usually just get someone angry and they say, if you want to provoke any... bad blood or whatever they say, then you came to the right place, yada yada yada. But other than that, nothing really big happens. So wonder what will happen this time. Will they keep the same mechanic going, or is there another idea?
I've got to believe it's going to tie into the fear and respect mechanic that we have seen. So if you go ahead and do that, I would like to think the AI would say, what do you think you're doing? Which may then mean enough that they have enough disrespect for you that they declare war.
You disrespected them by taking their land.
There's also another thing they mentioned. You are not allowed to drag your city if it comes within 2 tiles of another city. So suppose the AI forms a wall of cities, 4 tiles apart, like they usually do, then there's no way for you to come. It's just effectively blocked, and you can't say, hey, just let me through, I need to go and claim this tile behind you. But no, sorry, you have to either take the long way around, or not come at all.
Or just blow them up.
Or perhaps there's some kind of open borders equivalent that we see in Civ 5 that would allow you to pass through their territory.
I seriously doubt you're going to be passing cities by other people's cities.
Yeah, I think it's actually coded in the game. You're... cannot pass your city if it comes within 2 tiles of another city. The tile you want to move to will probably just become red and they will say, nope, sorry, can't move there. Go elsewhere.
Probably. Basic game rules.
That's probably what interests me the most about that whole concept.
You could certainly blockade across the water like that. Okay, that's an advantage if you do that to prevent perhaps somebody from crossing. But then it's how effective are these cities really? If that's their entire purpose, then I could see that being like a tactical thing that you might do on occasion, but I would like to think that that wouldn't be like a go-to every single time sort of a thing. That would be very situational, that you would want to do that because you're going to be farther ahead. Otherwise, oh, I could have just gone and settled this city a little farther away, and all that time I spent constructing a colonist, again, I could have settled it somewhere else, and the city's going to pay greater dividends than this, other than just being a troll.
Well, yeah, but there's also another thing. I don't know, because they haven't really showed that bit yet, but you can just steal ICS in Beyond Earth and get away with it. That unhealth thing doesn't really do much still. You can still spam cities like mad, and nobody will notice. I mean, yeah, you can grow, yeah, your production may suffer, something like that. But for the most part, just keep your trade routes going and you'll still have science, you'll still have gold, and hey, no worries. I mean, gold is used for buying stuff, science is used for researching more stuff to buy, and at the end of the day, you just get the equivalent of nukes, and well, that's it. That's the game.
I hope with what Dave and Will are talking about, which is when we look at an expansion pack, but we start questioning the design of our systems at a fundamental level, hopefully they're revisiting health, because you're right, in Beyond Earth, having negative health is not like having negative happiness in Civilization V. You're not penalized that much, and I think a lot of people tend to ignore the health thing, quite frankly, so hopefully that will be something that has been changed, so then in which case you are paying more attention to how many cities you're plonking down to limit not just the feasibility, but quite frankly, the design. Desirability of Infinite City Sprawl, ICS.
Yeah, that would definitely be one of the really, really big improvements.
You know what's inevitably going to happen, though? I mean, this would be a good change, but I'm already seeing that change happening, and then people complaining, hey, how come my health matters now? Yeah, well, okay. It will be an improvement, don't get me wrong, but we're a large enough community and a diverse enough opinion that someone will complain with that change. How dare you change what was already established? And I guess you can then say, well, if you don't like it, then don't get the expansion pack, except maybe whatever they do to Health and Rising Tide, maybe that will be backfilled into the base game. So then you still have to put up with it.
Yeah. kind of like the whole issue about micromanaging trade routes. Some people said, please include micromanaging. I really don't have to want to manage a million trade routes going from place A to place B to place C and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, if you really want good trade routes, then you have to micromanage them.
The panel from PAX Prime was very good, not as good as maybe some of the other panels we've seen, if only because the focus wasn't totally on Civilization Beyond Earth. But of course, they're trying to encompass all of the up-and-coming Firaxis titles. The one thing that was pervasive, whether they were talking about XCOM or Beyond Earth, and Darkness Fall 1985 in the YouTube comments was one of the first to point out, the game's sound is too loud to understand what they are saying. There are times when what David is saying, Will is saying, Jake is saying about XCOM, even the moderator Chris Waters is saying, is obliterated by the game sounds. And it's not like it just happened once. It was again and again and again. So while some things were lost, and it was annoying, it didn't take away from everything that you could hear, but okay, watch on screen. If they're about to take an action, don't talk or don't think that you're going to be able to hear what it is that they're saying. I'm certain whatever was missed, they'll say again if they haven't already said on another stream. And actually, even the volume on some of the panelists themselves, I mean, Jake was much louder than Will or Dave, or the moderator.
Well, Jake is kind of loud.
There was definitely no audio leveling done in post-production. The fact that Jake was louder than the other panelists wasn't anywhere near as distracting as the game sounds just overtaking what everyone else was trying to say. Either reduce the game volume or start shouting. One or the other. I'd rather just reduce the game sound.
Yeah, that's probably the way to go.
All right, and then that takes us to the panel, The Hybrid Affinities at War! Rawr! This was with Andrew Fredrickson, the lead producer on Civilization Beyond Earth Rising Tide, and Pete Murray, the marketing manager over at Firaxis Games. I actually thought that of all of the panels, and yes, there's still one more to go, that this was the most interesting. I would even argue that it generated the most discussion within the Civ community so far. But first, a little background. Playing as the Pan-Asian Cooperative, Andrew was, he's got a Harmony Supremacy focus, allied with Elodie of Franco-Iberia, and is at war with Kozlov of the Slavic Federation. It is mentioned with regards to PAC that the first wonder built in every city is free. Pete said, people are already asking, what does that mean exactly? And Andrew's response was, when we say something is free, we mean that it's only going to take you one turn to make it, quote unquote.
That's not free.
Yeah.
Not completely.
Point number one. And unless they've done some considerable rebalancing of the wonders, and I know they said they looked at rebalancing, the wonders in Civilization Beyond Earth aren't all that wonderful. They're often also limited to just the city itself as opposed to an effect empire-wide. Don't get me wrong, it's nice, but I don't know if it's as OP as people are already saying that it's going to be. It's powerful, but is it too powerful?
I don't know.
I guess too soon to say.
Ego knowledge, get +7 culture per wonder. You stack that in the city with a bunch of +% culture boosters, and all of a sudden you've got all the virtue trees finished.
I have read a comment somewhere that they have actually had the change of heart, realizing that that thing may be a bit OP. So rather than making it free, they just said cost half the time to build. So they give it like a 50% bonus hammers to build it. I don't know if that's true or a rumor, but it sounds more reasonable that way.
See, that's more reminiscent of Civilization V in Egypt getting, what was it, +25% construction for ancient wonders?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing is there are some wonders in there that can slingshot you early game, or at least like make the early game really, really, really easy, which means snowball. So it's really opportunity cost, yoinking, because all you have to do is hit the tech and then next turn, poof, done. I mean, to Dan's point, yeah, not a lot of the actual quote-unquote wonders are so overpowered that you pick it up and I win. Although there is that weird tech group up in the top corner that no one ever researches that has a bunch of wonders up there, so you never know.
Well, who knows? Maybe they will rebalance wonders to actually make them good, as Dan said. Who knows? Mm-hmm.
And or maybe move some around the tech web, or just overall the tech web itself, to make it more desirable to actually research that part of the tech web, and not just for a particular wonder, unless, of course, that wonder itself is so powerful that that's the only reason that you would go for that tech, in which case that also was a balance issue as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Let's not go from one extreme to the other. What else came up from this video was confirmation of what we had not only speculated, but it was more than just speculation. It was inferring, and we mentioned it earlier, if there's something that can be backported to beyond Earth with what's being done in the Rising Tide expansion, then that will happen. And sure enough, that came up. Andrew Fragerson said, quote, "We've gone through the AI routines for our workers and done a pretty significant overhaul. Some new improvements that these guys were not taking advantage of, and we've enhanced that. One of the many things that we're bringing back to base beyond Earth. Other things that are mentioned are balance changes for orbital units, air unit improvements to make those a little bit stronger, quote-unquote, the coloration of the tech web, which we had seen in some videos and screenshots, and the unit upgrade screen for existing content, of course. What you see in Rising Tide is what you are also then going to be able to see in Beyond Earth once Rising Tide is released."
That was good. That was really good. I like that one.
I must admit, when I saw what this last live stream was, this was the most recent one, it made me think of Turncast. I was like, wow, you're going to stream this? And it's this approach? No way.
They lied. They stole it.
Clearly.
Obviously.
No doubt. MP live stream.
Praxis decided to live stream some multiplayer. Crazy. For Sivbert, Andrew, and Stuart. Comp Stomp. Dream to show up. Ooh, new multiplayer.
There was some information that was discussed, but it was covered in the previous live streams. There was a couple of derpy moments, but essentially what you got a chance to see, I was actually kind of surprised in a way that it was co-op. Maybe it made that a little easier to do for the purpose of the live stream, because what would happen is at times you would get to see Stuart's screen, and then they would switch over to Andrew's screen. They were playing the game, but I don't know if they were truly, quote-unquote, playing the game so much as, okay, oh, here's this particular situation, let's talk about it, show some details, give a chance to people to grab some new information from the screen. It was an interesting distraction, but if you've been watching the other live streams, or you're really expecting any kind of new information, you will be disappointed. Nice to see a stream that wasn't, quote-unquote, just single player.
Yeah, because if you have to think back, pre-release of the expansions and or vanilla version of games, there hasn't really been a multiplayer specific type of pre-release video. They tended to shy away from showing that. So maybe they actually think it's going to be solid enough this time.
They were on a local area network, so it wasn't internet MP. However, the fact that it was something more than just single player is still encouraging.
And I'm sure it'll translate perfectly, too, when we try to play games over Steam or something, and not be on LAN.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it will work as well as intended. No problem.
Yep.
Yeah. The multiplayer works from the game mechanics aspect the same as C5. So apparently they liked what they saw in that one, so they just repeated it for this one. It's good. It's no problem.
Quite possible that what was a good trade route at one point in the game may no longer be a good trade route. So I wouldn't want it just like an automatic renewal. I would like, okay, your trade route's coming to an end. Give me an on-screen prompt. Remind me that this trade route is about to come to an end so that I could then decide to renew it or not, look at other possibilities where it could go to, rather than having to have a few extra clicks once my turn actually begins to then say, okay, now this trade convoy, trade vessel has popped up to say, where would you like me to go now?
Yeah, no, see, you basically just shifted clicks from one thing to another. You just want to do the clicks before it ends versus the clicks after it ends. Still the same amount of clicks because you're still going to go through and look at everything and then pick something. So that seems kind of eh. I'm perfectly fine with renewed trade routes. It makes it simple. Why? Because every single city of mine is going to send a trade route to the capital. Period. Always. I never want to renew that. Ever.
Well, I think it's perfectly fair to say that if you know that you never want it to pop up again, then have a little checkbox that says auto-renew. But if you don't, then you can have that option. And you're right, I'm just shifting the clicks around, but it's just easier for me to remember. To me, okay, I want to take care of this first. Let's get it out of the way.
Maybe you can pre-assign trade routes so they can update themselves automatically once they expire. And you like, hey, just since you're coming to a close, just go to that city over there. I'll have you worry about the entire logistics issues.
Or maybe have it say that, okay, when the trade route comes to an end, recalculate, give me the best results for prioritize internal, prioritize external, prioritize what's going to give the destination city or the receiving city more food, more production. That's getting into micro as well. But at the same time, you might feel like you're getting more bang for your buck because then at least you've given that trade route kind of standing orders, a template to decide where to go to, rather than you're trying to micromanage, okay, let's compare to this city and this city and that city and that city.
Yeah, I definitely like that. It's a good thing. I'd welcome that idea and even use it in a game quite often.
I think what we can agree, though, is don't not use trade routes. Oh, no, micro, I can't stand it. Well, the time that you spend, even the micro now, it will pay for itself.
And even bad use of trade routes is just too strong to not do.
Well, I'll say this. If you don't want to manage quite so many trade routes, then just make certain you settle around miasma, and then you won't have to worry about being able to trade with anyone because I can't get around. Hee.
I got two threads here. I'll start with the shorter one by Illiterist. Any land you would make UI more complex and less clear. Look at how this problem was solved in Endless Legend. The world is cut into provinces, and each province only supports one city. Forge is more or less even, settling without being too geometrical. Map itself, cities may look very close or very distant and diversely placed, yet you can't insert any more small cities. Another fix would be Master of Orion 2 system of placing outposts. I don't actually know how that works. They don't produce a thing and even cost maintenance, but settling on them would be an act of war. Oh, I see. Okay, well.
Yeah. Just as a preface here, what is this individual responding to from our last episode?
That's the claiming land segment.
Yes, from Research Lab.
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing is, in reference to Mutu, that's in space. You don't just settle in the middle of space. You have to settle in a system with planets. So these are finite locations to settle. Yes, you can use outposts, basically. What outposts were was claiming planets without actually sending a colony there yet. So you could do that, and it prevents people from actually going unless they want to declare war. But again, this is a finite base. Endless Legend. Ooh, they cut the world into provinces, and each province can only support one city. That basically just uses the planet is actually a solar system with a bunch of planets on it, and they all have finite bits. Again, that's not Earth-based or planet-based thinking. I mean, it is sort of board game-ish thinking, because there's been board games where you can do that, too. It's kind of like putting the hotel on a boardwalk sort of thing. But you would have to change Civ from being an expansion game where you can actually drop cities where you choose, look around for the resources, and then model it that way, to being this finite point location for settling, which I'm sure somebody could do, like Endless Legend, but it's not Civ, and therefore, meh. Also, it's kind of like you for, like, you know, all the provinces are already pre-built and all the cities are pre-built. So that doesn't really help the concept. Anyways, claiming land would make the UI more complex and less clear. Bullshit.
Yeah, no, not really. It depends what you do with the AI. I mean, it could if it's badly designed. That has happened before. But it doesn't bad have
UI.
To.
Yeah, bad UI is bad UI. But it could even be a different layer. Like resource button, you press that and resources pop up onto the map to see. You press it and they disappear.
Kind of like the orbital layer in Civilization Beyond Earth.
Yep, and the hex grid, and a bunch of other things. Less clear is questionable. More complex, definitely not. Slightly more complex than the fact that you'd have to have land claims, and then you'd have to have mechanics related around what happens if multiple people claim the same land. But that's more of a diplomacy thing. So, no, it will not be more complex and less clear, because it will be have been done properly to the point where it's obvious to both the player and the AI how to use it. And changing Civ to some planetary style, you can settle here, just seems like a bad idea.
Want to add a mechanic, let it be more transparent? Yes, I agree. The mechanics should be transparent, but we've touched on that. The UI is something that can be done properly, surrounding however you want the mechanic to be functioning. It's a serious consideration, but I don't think it's a reason not to implement some sort of land claiming and diplomacy aspect. Because it's in practice, you can handle it very easily as long as the UI is there and the AI knows how the mechanic works. So if you make the mechanic require too much complex long-range planning, then the AI is probably going to be bad at it. and it might be a detraction from how well the AI can perform in single player, but other than that, I don't really see the issue. And yeah, EU4 coalitions are complete trash. They should not be showing up in Civ 5 ever. Dogpiling weaker nations and protecting the larger ones and being extremely exploitable is not good for anybody.
On the Master of Orion 2 placing outposts, they don't produce a thing and even cost maintenance, but settling on them would be an act of war. It actually reminded me of Civilization 3 and the colonies in Civilization 3, where you want to claim the land, but claiming the land is really about the resource. That's what you want, but you need to be able to protect that colony, except if another civ kind of went do-do-do-do-do, oh, I see you have a colony here. Well, I'm going to settle a city, and poof, your colony is gone. Okay, maybe that should have actually triggered something to say, hey, about that, you can go ahead and do that, but you are going to go ahead and, in fact, declare war.
Yeah, I think at least you need some sort of positive diplomacy, or at least the lack of a negative for declaring on nations or fighting nations over that territory. If someone does that, violates a claim, violates a colony, whatever it is, you really should not be seen as the aggressor for declaring on them for it or getting into a war with them for it and taking that land. It's just silly. But the whole warmongering menace thing in general is a little silly of how it works.
Okay, yes, onward.
Onward and upward.
Proposal by Shaglio to just have cities keep expanding and culture past the fifth ring, but you can't do it until sixth ring just to make the map look a little cleaner. I mean, okay. I would like to see the land be usable by endgame. The whole, let's provide you a map, let's use up space, RAM, whatever on the map, and then actively discourage through game mechanics the viability of filling up the map in what is still functionally a 4X game is problematic. Yeah. And yeah, okay, having cities expand beyond 5 tiles, I actually don't have a problem with that, especially if it doesn't change the gameplay beyond that whole lot, but it still doesn't solve the fundamental issue with tall versus means, wide nonsense.
It just means any strategic or luxury resource that pops into there would be associated to that city, and so you'd get access to it if you have improved it. That'd be the only benefit of extending cultural expansion.
Yeah. In practice, though, you're probably going to do something to get that resource actively rather than waiting for it. But yeah, it might give you a couple things here and there.
Yep.
Lucius has a comment that you could use units for the units lying around, use to grab oil and other stuff beyond the borders, put claims on, I guess, or GGs with Fortress, whatever. Then, interesting point by Hale, and this is something that's relevant to Civ 4 and Civ 5, and previous Civs even more so than Civ 4 and Civ 5, and that's the importance of the city tile and how that impacts ICS-type strategies. And yes, it is a free tile that provides yields, and even in Civ 5, and especially in the early Civ 5, before there were so many penalties on expansion, that city tile meant a lot, because you can do things that make the city tile more valuable, and then you have it immediately unsettling a city. It doesn't have to grow, and of course, the larger a city is, the more food cost you get to grow an additional population, so this is an instant tile, and in each new city, of course, has at least one citizen as well. That was a foundational aspect of the ICS strategy, is to get whatever low-tier buildings provide the most utility, and then just abuse the city tile in limited growth that doesn't have as much cost or time sink to get.
Yeah, I think we really, really, really glossed over it during that discussion, because we basically said, like, change the game mechanics to not allow for it to be the most useful thing, rather than trying to punish, and that's kind of like a really glossy way of saying, okay, the game mechanic is the city tile is very important. There's a lot of basic things that just give you stuff for it. But yeah, it's a fundamental reason why ICS was useful, was that all this easy access stuff.
And it's true. A lot of people don't think about it. They're like, what would Civ 5 play like if you completely axed any default yields in the city tile? For the early game, it would be a lot slower for certain, but it would be a very different looking game.
Well, if you axed all of the plus per city bonuses,
I think just all the default yields. I mean, you could still leave the plus per city bonuses, maybe.
No,
but
plus per city is one of the reasons to go ICS.
Yeah, but if you're yanking out the default bonus on the city, then you have to invest to make ICS more viable.
No, because then you just have all these things that give you plus per city, and they become the default.
Yeah.
Huh? The default is only 2 production, 2 food, basically, depending. So, really, all you're really doing by removing that is just very, very tiny slow. There's a lot of game mechanics that give you plus per city that actually blow way past that.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Default. That's true in Civ 5. So and relative yield is different in Civ 5 too. In Civ 4, the value of an irrigated corn tile, a wet corn, something that had fresh water, your city tile is giving you 2 food and 1 hammer. That was giving you 6 food. That kind of yield was not uncommon. Most cities had at least 5 or 6 yield tile that you were working right away. So it was doubling up having an improved resource versus your city. And in Civ 5, that's less true. It's much easier to make the city tile competitive with some of the better tiles in the game. And I think that it did lend the push towards ICS early in Civ 5, is that relative yield difference.
Yep. And yes, the city population growth curve is pretty ugly.
Yeah.
It's faster to produce 100 population in 10 cities than it is to produce it in 2.
An enormous margin in that case.
Yes, it's insanely easy comparatively. More cities, more land, more resource, yes, of course. And more places to build units. I think we kind of touched on, but more ability to build units. And any unit.
Doesn't marginal tile, use. Too.
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, this is, say, GDR. I can buy that in any city.
Yep.
That city could just be a brand new city that's just dropped, has absolutely no buildings, and all of a sudden, poof, you know how to make a GDR.
Wow. If you have the cash set up, you can easily buy stuff to make a promoted GDR in that city that you settled this turn.
My mind keeps coming back, actually, to Lucius's point about perhaps in Civ 6, another unit could be used for a similar purpose to the Great General in Civ 5. Maybe after a certain age, explorers can be used the same as Great Generals now, but without the fortress. Thing is, with a Great General, that comes from experience in combat, and oh yes, okay, you finish Liberty and you decide you want to use the Great General, fine, for an example.
Honor has it too, by the way.
If it's a unit that you can construct as an explorer, and then, okay, maybe that explorer is consumed by saying, okay, this land in the otherwise apparent middle of nowhere is mine, I could see someone deciding that it's to my advantage to say, hey, here's a certain choke point here. Why don't I construct 3 or 4 explorers? They'll be consumed. But then if anyone wants to come into my land by land, then they're going to have to declare war on me, and I can just kind of completely, otherwise diplomatically, block this spot off, even though it's far flung from my empire, because I don't want someone to settle there. I'm not convinced I would want to see something like that, and I'm not saying he's suggesting that, but I guess I'm already starting to think, how could this be abused?
Although that has some tactical value, because you'd have multiple players doing that and vying for that spot. I think you would need a mechanic whereby you can change who controls that border outside of city range.
Yeah.
And that way you can contest it, because contesting choke points like that, that was an important consideration throughout historical warfare, is some of the valuable terrain areas.
Exactly. Yeah,
that mattered a lot.
Next to the cities. But yeah, no, it would have to be something along the lines of the claimed. Like, I have claimed this with an explorer.
Yeah.
But that doesn't stop people from walking through it. It wouldn't stop units from marching through. It wouldn't stop somebody from bringing a settler and just plopping it in the middle of your claimed lands and instantly wiping out all your claims because it's actually owned.
Possession being 9/10. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the law.
And it wouldn't be a declaration of war instantly, although it would probably lead to one, et cetera, et cetera.
You didn't respect my claim.
Yeah.
Negative modifier, yeah.
That's one thing I don't like about Civ 5 is the whole land contest city settlement thing. Once the settler is planted, that's a pretty high defense fabrication out of nowhere. You know, I missed all the previous civs having to really defend that with units, even after you settled it. Like, you were making a risk on forward settling somebody, because they could just nail your stuff so hard right away if you weren't prepared to deal with it.
Yeah, in Civ 5, it's just the, hey, look, I have instant defense, and I can buy walls and castles and units. And
yeah, and immediately start shooting. Like, come on now.
I like what Beyond Earth did. You found an outpost. It's not boom, instant city right away. You can start building, constructing, high defense. That's good. We'd like to see that in mainstream, giant air quotes, mainstream Civ.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that Beyond Earth really improved on, in my opinion, is that land contesting potential.
It was a really good idea, definitely.
Plus, you can go destroy the outpost, and unless you have the military policy, it just disappears. You don't have to have, ooh, my population's upset because I'm burning down a city.
Yeah.
Yes, that. Yep.
It's just gone. Dead. Bye. Although I don't like how, just because of the way the game's coded, when an outpost goes to a city, if the outpost had 0 hit points left and you couldn't quite kill it, it insta-fills all the way to full hit points when it becomes a city.
Yeah.
Yeah, that shouldn't happen. It should be damaged. The whole point of contesting it is that you actually do something there.
Yeah. I think that's just part of the code. Whenever they quote-unquote convert from one state to another, what they're really doing is just creating brand new, and they didn't preload data with it, i.e. how damaged is it?
Yeah, if whatever the colony's strength is, if it's down to 10%, and then on that next turn rollover you're about to take it, it becomes a city, then okay, now it can have 10% of whatever 100% of the city would be, but it's not back to 100% now of the greater strength as even compared to when you started attacking the outpost. That's just, wait, what? No.
Yep.
Don't do that.
That's just annoying.
Civ 5.
The user Vesper1987 asks, when are mounted units most useful? Okay, so I notice in many of my games, AI focus on making mounted units which have high moving range, and I know that's a huge bonus. However, I find them useless during sieges. Is there a point in making mounted army while sieging? Well, last time I made two of those, I could 10,000 spots his units, also to reveal cities so I can attack it from a safe distance. Is that the only good use for them, or I'm missing something?
Yes.
And making a zero-hit point city with them. They're pretty good for that, too.
My immediate response to this is, no, you're not missing something. I'm basically using mountain units just about the same way. I keep them afar. I let the damage dealers deal damage to a city. And then I just move in my mountain units three or more tiles away from the city, walk him in, capture the city, and then just walk back out. Easy.
Mounted units are best used out in the fields where there's no cities around, basically.
Well, many of
the surround and pound thing going on, so they are good there. And they're also good for dealing damage and getting out. So like it's easier to conserve them because they can move after attacking. So you can kill units and get out of danger. So they are pretty good in the open. But they're also really good for sniping stuff near cities and getting away from the city, or for taking the weakened cities. There aren't that many units that have 4+ moves that you can just run in and nail the city from outside of crossbow range. That's something you wind up using them for as well. You don't just slam them into the city in most cases.
Yeah, especially when you get to artillery or bombers at that level, then you really want more cav floating around because they can just zip in after the city's been bombed to crap and take it.
I feel like even in the knight crossbow era, though, you just you shoot down the city with the crossbow and then you run a knight in there.
Yeah.
And they double as units that can wreck stuff that you're shooting with crossbows before you get to the city, too.
Yeah, it's a question of what type of terrain as well. Even if it is all heavy terrain, since they have 4 movement, usually, that means 2 rough terrain hexes per turn rather than just 1.
Yeah.
So you can get there faster. They're great for mass pillaging.
Pillaging, cripple their economy, you cripple their tiles, you cut them off from food, from production, from gold, and that's also good.
And all this, and yet Dan still won't trade me 2 gold a turn for a horse. I don't understand it.
I have enough horse for my own purposes. Thank you, Fel. I don't need your overpriced horses.
Overpriced? Look at all you could do with it. You could pillage more than 2 gold a turn with that horse unit.
I have my own sources of horse. That's the thing. I don't need yours. I'm fielding enough.
Yeah, you're wrong. You can always have more.
If you do have some infantry, because, I mean, if you look through the thread, I mean, basically up until cav, the infantry is usually better because pikes versus knights. But one of the other things you can use with their mounted is, say you do have some longswords, and you've only got a couple of them because you only have a couple steel, then you can use your mounted units to pop in and provide extra flank without actually using them to attack, and then they can move off to go help extra flank on others' units. They can be useful. The only problem is that they get hard stomped by pikes, so you need a big surround.
They're not spammer units, but even then, having like 2 of them is great for just the reason you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You get the surround and pound bonus, and also you can clean up the damaged units.
Especially if you go honor.
Oh, yeah. Oh, then it's pretty lulzy. You can actually kill pikes with knights. Like, you surround them with like 3-4 of them and just
squish it.
Yeah.
Horse units usually have an anti-wounded promotion as well.
Yeah.
So if you shoot them first, then all of a sudden they're getting extra promotion-based boosts. So knowing how to use them properly.
Many of their weaknesses comes down to the fact that they don't have defensive bonuses.
Yep.
And they are especially weak against cities. While we have discussed that already, and didn't they not have a penalty against cities back in one of the earlier versions, back when Gods and Kings was delayed?
Oh, vanilla.
They were way too good in vanilla, because there's also a penalty for defending on flat terrain, and on top of everything else. So, like, you had the flanking bonus, you had the honor flanking bonus, and you had a penalty for defending on a flat terrain. Rounding a musket with enough horsemen, you could one-shot it. And then on top of that, you could surround the cities with them, and then just hit the cities and run away. And because they were strong enough relative to the cities, you wouldn't lose them. And you could just rotate hits on the city with, like, 4 to 6 horsemen and just take cities without losing units.
Tying into previous points, if you're on the city-taking track, you've used your siege units, you move the mounted unit in there to ultimately take the city, and yes, talking, of course, melee mounted units here. You move them in there, and then, okay, you want to keep them going on, even though the city strength is down, you're still going to take some damage. As you're pillaging, if you pillage after that, not only are you going to get the gold, but you're going to get a little bit of health back, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also a good thing. But we forgot to mention one thing. How about Mongolian mounted units?
Oh, well,
I think
yeah,
that's an edge case. I mean, those are so obviously good.
Yeah, same for the camel archers.
Same thing with, yeah, camel archers. Even horse archers, despite their limited upgrading, are just amazing units.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything that's ranged horse is just crazy.
You move in, shoot, move out. Yeah, that's...
Yeah. Yeah, no, when people complain about mounted units, they're only complaining about the melee ones.
Yeah.
And they're never complaining about Mandicav in that case because, well, Mandicav don't have a penalty versus cities.
Yeah, those are good too. They're not Keshiks or archers, but they're good too.
But you can actually attack a city with one.
Yes.
Because they don't have the penalty versus cities.
One mounted unit that we haven't mentioned is the chariot archer. That doesn't get as much attention as it used to for Gods and Kings because there was the introduction, of course, of the composite bowman to fill in the gap between the archer and the crossbowman. But if you want a really early rush and you have horses, the chariot archer, they are slightly more powerful than the archer. So if you use that effectively, combine that with a melee unit, you can actually rush maybe that much faster. And then they're going to have those upgrades.
Oh, if you get logistics on them, yeah, it's... Their upgrade path is awful.
Oh,
but having like 2 or 3 of them with like range 3 logistics is just stupid. They stay good a long time if you use them that way.
Or if you're Egypt.
Oh, well, yeah.
You go War Chariot instead.
I mean, they're not Civ 4 good, but they're good.
Well, War Chariot, yeah, they're like top 3 in Civ 4. Unique unit.
Boy.
Logistics, Keshiks, and Camel Archers are just fun to use.
So when you're those civilizations, finding and improving horse tiles is important, as even as compared to otherwise, if you're not those civs. And finding horse on the map is usually not an issue.
Well, if you're not finding horse on the map, what are you doing finding it next to you?
Banning luxuries in the World Congress. Is it just for screwing someone over?
Yes.
Next.
Yes. Yes. Dunk... I'm just going to call him Dunk. I know it's possible to ban luxuries in the World Congress. In-game information states that this is for luxuries that are immoral or otherwise negative. And a real-world counterpart would be banning whaling or banning real fur coats or blood diamonds or something. My question is there any in-game advantages to banning luxuries? Do certain ideologies get bonuses for banning them? Or is it just to harm whichever Civ controls those luxuries? Hey, AI, can I get a copy of that resource that I don't have right now? No. Okay, then you won't get it either. Lol, 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 lol. Oh, do you have 10 copies of that that you were trading away for some extra gold? Aw, too bad. LOL. It's not that -4 happiness hit. Not really. It's, I know that you have cornered the market. You're not willing to give it to me in a trade, probably because we don't have very good relations. So I'm looking to screw you over. Yeah, -4 happy, maybe as a fringe thing. But it's more about, I don't get a hold of it, so you can't use that to help your economy. Forget it.
There may be exceptions to that. I've experimented in certain games with banned luxuries, and I'm pretty sure the AI was still willing to buy them for some reason.
Yeah, it's a bit of an issue. I mean, if they are banned, you shouldn't be able to sell them.
Exactly. But sometimes, if I don't have anything better to propose, I try to ban my own luxury and then sell them all for free.
Hmm.
It's a good strategy. I mean, I give money and I don't really lose anything because I'm not receiving any happiness from it anyway.
If you know that a Civ would be happy with you, like through your ideologies and your spies, and you know, hey, you know what? They would actually support banning this luxury and you're trying to curry their favor. Okay, maybe on balance, that's worth it to you as well. So maybe it's not just about, well, it's about screwing someone else over, but it's also maybe about getting closer to an AI or two.
Yep.
Well, yeah, but usually every luxury that you want to ban will get at least someone angry. So in more than one occasion, by banning one luxury, it will make everyone mad. But can bet that at least one will be mad, whatever luxury you want to ban, or anyone else for that matter. So, yeah, it's definitely just for screwing people over.
Yep.
That's its primary function, at least.
It makes the game fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely makes the game fun. Quite often, I just feel like trolling everyone. And, hey, you know what? You got all that solved. Well, no, you're not going to have any use from it, because my 20 city states will make sure that it will be banned by me.
Oh, they'll and be you... salt.
Yeah, that will be salty.
I would say a personal favorite of mine is if you're in a situation where on the map, okay, so mercantile city states, yeah, okay, porcelain and jewelry. I'm not going to be able to get a hold of that happiness because they've got that city state locked down. I'm not going to be able to take it by force. So I'm going to go and propose that we're going to ban this unique luxury from this mercantile city state. That is especially fun.
Yeah, but in a deity game, not really effective because the AIs have 50 million happiness. I don't know how.
Oh, they're just given the bonuses for it, so they're not playing the same game on that level.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. The Buzzing says in the chat, it'd make more sense if you could set up trade routes and then view and cancel them from a trade UI whenever you wanted, making a 20-30 turn locking when first set up, or a cost to set up the trade route. Okay, so also the possibility of, I want to send my trade route to somewhere else before the 20-30 turn set is over.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fine. Although I think that if you were to do that, maybe to tie into this fear and respect mechanic, maybe you could have the AI say, sorry, why did you just cancel the trade route with us? That wasn't very nice.
Yeah, well, it's because you were about to declare war on me, and I would lose my trade route and have to build it again.
Got a better deal elsewhere.
Yeah.
Or that, yeah.
So, other than that...
Yeah, well. Mm-hmm. That was small.
I think we're done for this episode.
I think Stormtroopers waves. I'm going to have conversations with other people now. I'm done with this.
Yep. Speaking about being done... Say hi to your mom.
Yeah.
Hey-o.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
That's okay. You're too polite to say you were getting bored with us, you know? Just take a hint, guys. Oh, sure.
So this has been episode 238 of the Polycast. I have been your host, Mad Jin, and I will not be here next week. Technically, because if you actually think about it, it'll be next week once this episode goes out. Huh?
Yes, that's true.
Because it'll be Fraxicon! And I may or may not live stream from Fraxicon, because this sort of worked out. If the wireless there is not bad, I could probably just slap the iPad down somewhere at noon, since there's no panels.
Has my shipment of internet cookies reached you yet?
I don't know yet. Still hungry. Send more cookies.
Didn't you say you were going to hide the camera under your hat or something?
No, I just carry my phone around. Just do it anyways. We'll see. But that is next week. Or 2 weeks, depending on when you listen to this.
Or it could have been years ago.
Yes, very, very true.
It's true.
Depending upon when you listen to.
Otherwise, guest, Stormtrooper.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And, of course, the usual co-hosts and cohorts and co-troublemakers, Dan Q.
No description can hold me.
And, of course, the Mean Team.
Peace. Oh, I'm hearing myself an echo.
Yeah.
Who is that? Ow, that spell. Okay.
I'm echoing? No. Because I'm hearing myself echo.
Yeah. Ow.
It must be you.
Is it you again? Is it you again, Stormtrooper?
Nope. It's my headphones. But I can definitely hear myself, which is probably not expected.
Can you see who's echoing?
Let's look.
Ha 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 ha. Wah wah, wah wah.
And here's me. And I can still hear myself.
Yeah. I didn't notice this until Matt was on the call.
Yeah, that's true.
Nope, not my fault.
It's a little frustrating because it's not quite loud enough for Skype to pick up where it's coming from.
Yeah. Yeah, we probably don't want to do the episode like this, though.
We'll wreak havoc on editing.
Trying to clean out, like, an echo that's concurrent with audio you want to keep is just going to be a mess.
Yeah, the only time I'm not hearing the echo is when you're speaking, Mad.
Oh.
Yeah, it's just
Let
Mad.
Let me drop
that's
the call and see what happens.
Okay. Yep, look at that.
Yeah?
Well, no more echo.
It's not me.
Like your comment, Phil. I only noticed it when Mad joined the call. Mad, it's not me.
Whatever you say, Mad.
One's an expansion pack, and there's like, or is expansion pack even what people say anymore? Expansion probably just suffice. They're a little different.
Just drop the pack. It's the cool people say expansion.
Yeah,
X pack actually. If you want to be X-pack. Real cool,
no,
yeah.
Not that cool. Definitely not that cool.
The Aquilon is sort of an air carrier. So it supports aircraft, but it also has like long-range bombard, and it's this like halfway living thing, so it's very resilient. The direction we gave to the concept art for this thing was, all right, imagine a meat zeppelin. Sure enough. That's
oddly enough, not the first time that that phrase has been uttered at Firaxis. I don't know what that means.
They knew just what I meant.
Right.
Sort of stunt wars of what different pictures you can draw on the ocean with your city as you move it around.
You don't want to know the pictures that we've drawn.
I think we all know, Will. Yeah.
I also realized I said cargo ships instead of trade vessels. Sorry, Internet. Will not happen again.
I'm actually using the leash ability to claim an alien and then using that to wipe out other aliens, which works really well with one of the virtues that I have, which basically gives me science for every alien killed and alien nest destroyed.
Okay.
So basically running around, murdering aliens.
And using aliens to murder aliens.
Using aliens to murder each other. Got an artifact.
What'd you get? Check that out. Ooh. A collapsing family library.
Apparently I need to get more involved with my family.
Seriously. This reminds me of the last time I tried to move my house. All the stuff ended up all over the place.
I can get even more.
Towards the end of the video, Pete Murray said, "No, sorry guys, that's coming soon. Not to worry," in response to, "Are you going to reveal what the fourth sponsor is?" And at this point, I'm wondering if, yes, we're going to reveal the fourth sponsor. This is the release date for Rising Tide. That's when we will reveal the fourth sponsor.
Well, that would be a reveal.
It could be Firaxicon.
I don't think they will reveal the fourth sponsor before they release the game.
Well, the fact that you're going to be able to play Rising Tide from what we hear at Firaxicon, unless they specifically strip that out, someone's going to come across it.
Yeah, you would think.
Oh, you know, the fourth sponsor will be Day Zero DLC. For free.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That'd certainly be popular. Yep. MP live stream.
Yes, and?
Yeah, I got nothing. You guys go ahead.
Well, that's convenient.
And I also didn't watch it, so there you go, Dan.
So let's jump over to Stuart for a second, because Stuart, you're about to grab a resource pod over here. Oh, no, you're not. Oh, just as we said that, the Scarabula. And a nest. So,
yay.
They're really happy to see you.
Thanks, Pete.
Yeah, I'm glad to help. Anytime.
Well, neither are the sea dragons.
Neither are the sea dragons.
No.
So close. So close. I wonder when you're going to spend
Andrew,
that upgrade.
Run.
Hey, what'd you get from the resource pod?
Hiding spot. I like how she says, "What on earth are you doing here?"
Yeah.
Because they're not on Earth.
Speaking of Civ 5.
You.
Isn't that the first forum talk topic there, Storm?
He might be thrown off because this was originally my topic. It changed at some point.
Actually, no, it looks, no, he actually just dropped.
He might have thrown off because he's not on the call.
You segued so badly, he ran away.
I disagree with your segment. Hang up.
Hey, you're back.
Yeah, my internet apparently died from...
bad segue puns?
Recorded September 19th, 2015. Fraxis panel clips courtesy GameSpot. Fraxis livestream clips copyright 2K Games. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.